You'll hear our first case, which is Schaffner versus Monsanto Corporation, number 22-3075. And counsel, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. David Zients for Appellant Monsanto Company. With your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal.
That'll be granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Over the course of decades, EPA has reviewed the science, concluded that glyphosate is not likely to cause cancer, and determined that FIFRA does not require a cancer warning on glyphosate products like Roundup. That basic point should resolve this appeal. Congress enacted a uniformity provision under which states may not require labeling that is—
Well, of course, that's not a uniform position. I mean, others take a different view, as we all know. So
sure, Your Honor. The Ninth Circuit has interpreted the preemption provision one way. The 11th Circuit has now issued a decision that has not, fully answered the question, but its reasoning on a key point is different from the Ninth Circuit. Your Honor, I only meant to refer to the name that Congress gave to Section 136VB, which is uniformity. The idea, certainly the goal here would be uniformity of interpretation eventually. Ultimately, that may need to be resolved for the Supreme Court. But the question here is how you interpret this statute that is called uniformity provides that states may not require labeling that is in addition to or different from the labeling that is required under FIFRA. Here we have—
And when it says that, I'd like to focus on those last three words. It's under this subchapter, FIFRA has to be codified in that subchapter. Right. But the registration themselves are not part of the statute. They're pursuant to a regulatory regime, and then they're through an agency action, a registration action. So when we look, why should we look to agency action as the basis for preemption, at least express preemption, right, when the express language of the statute says under this chapter and the subchapter, and the registration is not specified in the subchapter?
Sure, Your Honor. I think there is an answer that ties into binding precedent from the Supreme Court. And then also, if I could then sort of walk through some of the statutory provisions that I think get you there. But a place to start is the Supreme Court's decision in Regal versus Medtronic, which is very similar. The Supreme Court has said it is a similar express preemption provision. A lot of the features of the statutory framework are the same. What the Supreme Court, said there was that when the agency undertakes a particular kind of safety approval for medical devices, that agency process imposes requirements under the medical device amendments. So under the statute, under is the word that is used in the medical device amendments as well. And what the Supreme Court said is because of the way the statute works, where the agency is required to do a safety review, to make determinations, and then the regulated party has to use the product and the label that as it has been approved by the agency, those statutory provisions work together to, in the words of the Supreme Court, impose requirements under the statute. And we think it works the exact same way here. We are talking about registration, and the fundamental requirement here is that it is illegal to sell a pesticide without registration. What the DC Circuit said in the Reckitt-Benckiser case is that a registration is a product-specific license that places conditions on how you can sell a product. So if the agency tells you this is what you need to warn, and Congress directed it to determine what safety warnings are necessary, when you go through that process, the agency is giving content to what is required under FIFRA there.
Does Bates also deal with that? Does Bates give us the ability to not only look at whatever statutory provisions might apply, but also regulations?
Yes, Your Honor. So Bates says that the EPA regulations give content to the requirements under FIFRA. Bates was sort of dealing with the kind of macro question of how does preemption work writ large under this statute? The one view that had been proposed by the defendant in Bates was that there's basically any state labeling, any failure to warn claim, any state labeling claim would be preempted. The Supreme Court rejected that. Instead, it adopted a parallel requirements view where, you know, state labeling claims are preempted unless they are truly parallel. They are genuinely equivalent. And what Bates says is you do look to what EPA has done. It wasn't presented with the kind of issue that we have here, but it talked about genuine equivalence. It talked about what the EPA does. It gave this example about caution versus danger.
Those examples were in the statute as opposed to a registration label. The caution and the, I think it was danger, were actually defined terms in the regulations, whereas you're advocating for a position where we rely on the labeling, a non-statutory, non-regulatory definition.
Sure, Your Honor. So I would respectfully disagree that it's not regulatory. Mm-hmm. Congress has delegated.
Well, it's not explicitly in
sure,
the regs.
It is not a notice and comment regulation. And the point I would make is that Congress delegated to the EPA different ways to regulate. EPA, a long time ago, I think it was 1984, considered, are we going to go through notice and comment regulation for every labeling decision? It said we essentially can't do that. We're going to do it in this case-by-case registration process. On the background of that, Congress then legislated and enacted this re-registration provision, Section 136A-1, and it actually referred to the outcome of that as regulatory action. So it may not be sort of a notice and comment rule that is written in the CFR the way that we may be used to seeing, but it's a very formal process that Congress created.
And so just to tease that out, you typically think of notice and comment as being a way of manufacturing or generating rulemaking and rules. It's called informal rulemaking. You don't have to do notice and comment to give a license or registration. Typically, you just have a proceeding before an agency. It can be a formal proceeding, a trial-like proceeding, or an informal proceeding. It seems that Congress is kind of mixing and matching a little bit of the process for rulemaking for the process for issuing a registration, because typically registrations, you just have a hearing, not notice and comment. The fact that they're mixing and matching, should we read from that that it has less force of law, or should we read from that that it has more force of law, or is that just irrelevant from looking at kind of a force of law analysis?
Your Honor, I don't, our view is that force of law tends to be most relevant in implied or impossibility preemption context.
That's what the 11th Circuit said.
I think if we're thinking about force of law, the Supreme Court has said it is not just notice and comment rulemaking that is force of law. And I agree with you. There's sort of, Congress came up with a sort of sui generis procedure here, but it is a quite formal one. In fact, there are agency regulations that do involve notice and comment for this. The statutory re-registration in 1993 for glyphosate did go through notice and comment. I would also just go back to Regal and the procedure there. The Supreme Court didn't dwell on was there notice and comment as part of this pre-market approval, and I think there was not. These medical devices would go to the FDA. There was a rigorous safety and labeling review process, much like what you have under FIFRA. And the Supreme Court said under a very similar statutory preemption provision, when the agency does that, when the agency decides, this is what is required under the statute. Here is an approved way of making this product. A state can't then impose requirements that are in addition to that.
Well, now, do you have an explanation as to why the EPA has permitted some manufacturers to unilaterally add cancer warnings by notification? How does that affect your argument?
Your Honor,
The Ninth Circuit cited such a thing in its Hardeman opinion.
Sure, Your Honor. So if I could give, I think there's an answer to that for our express preemption argument and for our impossibility preemption argument.
Well, let's go with express.
Sure. So for express preemption, Your Honor, we don't think it matters at all what the agency allows. Courts are quite clear applying this parallel requirements framework for express preemption. The question
is— But along the lines of Judge Phipps's point, it's a little mix and match. You're saying, oh no, they've got it. There's a solid, very formal procedure, and yet you can modify it. Manufacturers can modify it with EPA's approval. Or yeah, without with DPA saying sure.
Your Honor, so you're right. I want to distinguish between what the EPA may or may not allow versus what EPA requires. You know, EPA goes through a process and decides. It is required by the statute to decide, you know, what safety warnings are necessary and required to protect health. If it is necessary under FIFRA, EPA is required to impose it. If it doesn't do that, you know, maybe would EPA allow it? Perhaps, but under
Express preemption. Yeah, but isn't your whole point that it's not? I mean, it's not really listed anywhere, as Judge Chung said as well. There's not a bunch of regs that say exactly what you have to do here. It's up to the EPA's discretion, right?
And isn't the broader import that if the manufacturer can add, then why is that not misbranding? Whether it's allowed or required, I think the question is. Is that misbranding? Is in addition to misbranding or not at the level of the label? So if the manufacturer can do it and it's not misbranding, why is a state requirement misbranding?
Sure. So in order, you know, state is only permitted, and Bates says this, a state is only permitted to enforce a requirement under FIFRA. So if what you are doing does not violate FIFRA, a state cannot require you to do that. I think Bates says that, a number of cases interpreting how this parallel requirements view of preemption works say that. So if a state, if EPA has considered this and has decided not to impose a cancer warning, then it would be a requirement in addition to the federal requirements for a state to require it.
I'm interrupting you. I'm sorry. But the thought crosses my mind then that you're really pushing this genuine equivalent standard to mean really close to identicalness in terms of what the requirement is. There may be downstream consequences as far as remedies. Maybe the state could say, when you violate the federal standard, you can get all of these extra remedies, maybe punitive damages, maybe other things. That might not be a problem. But as far as what the requirement is itself, you're basically saying genuine equivalence is really close to identicalness, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think it depends on the circumstance. You could have something like efficacy, where EPA has waived review of efficacy issues, and that's a situation like Bates. And there you would just look at, in general, what is the general federal statute? EPA hasn't given any content to it at all. And then you would make that genuine equivalence comparison. Where EPA has actually made the statutorily required determination about what safety warnings are required, then I do think you look at what Bates says is you should only be liable under state law if you would also be liable under federal law.
So the standard is basically one of equivalence. Now, what liability flows from that, states can choose to make it way more generous or way more stringent or whatever they want. But the underlying standard for liability, you are basically telling us that genuine equivalence is when at least the EPA speaks is, forgive the pun, equivalent to identicalness.
Yeah, I think that is right, Your Honor. And Bates makes this point that the way it describes this parallel requirements rule is that states are entitled to add remedies, to provide their own remedies for violating federal labeling standards. So if there is any difference, you know, to the federal labeling standards, is in addition to or different from.
And so that's why your argument's express preemption, not preemption in the field, because states still have some ability to work there, but not in the setting of the liability standard.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I see I'm over time. If I could respond to that.
Go ahead.
Sure, Your Honor. You know, states have a lot of leeway. Congress made a decision here. If a state thinks that this product is truly unsafe, it can ban it. It can decide that a product may not be on the market at all. A state, you know, there is a petition process in the EPA that there's no reason a state couldn't go to the EPA and start a petition for cancellation if it thinks that the requirements should be different. Congress, the one provision that we are focusing on here is where Congress said the one thing states can't do, they cannot add their own labeling requirements that are different from or in addition to the requirements under FIFRA.
Right. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear you on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Chip Becker. I'm here for the plaintiffs. Under our constitutional system, states retain the sovereignty to enact laws for the health and safety of their citizens. Under the Supremacy Clause, of course, Congress can override that sovereignty, and when it does so clearly and plainly. Here, FIFRA has a preemption provision. And the question is, what did Congress say? This is a straightforward question of statutory construction. Did Congress, in enacting the preemption provision in FIFRA, override a state law claim, a Pennsylvania state law claim for strict liability sounding in failure to warn? And the answer to that question emphatically is no. There are certain things that Congress did, but it didn't do that. And this is apparent at every level of the analysis. And the most straightforward level is just at the plain language of the statute, which asks, and it's new for me to have to use glasses, which says that a state shall not, and of course we've been talking about this, a state shall not impose or continue in effect any requirements for labeling or packaging in addition to or different from those required under this chapter. So
doesn't the title also have significance? Uniformity. That's a good point. I mean, the EPA is looking to have a uniform label, and Bates said, "Hey, imagine if 50 states did 50 different things."
Well, and of course, in Bates is talking about fonts and sort of the particular characteristics of the label. And I think Judge Chung, maybe that was to your point about caution and danger and what happens if a state says that if a pesticide having a certain characteristic has to be identified this way, but the federal government says it has to be identified a different way, and we can't have that chaos, right? We can't have that chaos. But the way this analysis proceeds in terms of asking ourselves whether there is an impermissible state law requirement that is vitiated, preempted by this uniformity language, and recognizing that uniformity here is a term that's being used in the context of a statute, which is all about cooperative federalism. The states have authority. Congress also is exercising authority. What is the relationship between the state sovereignty, the state power, and the federal power? And that boils down to a question of comparison.
But when we look at the uniformity clause, it uses the phrase requirements for labeling or packaging. Mm-hmm. And a failure to warn claim is going to be premised on a duty that's breached with respect to labeling or packaging. And so a breach of a duty feels like a requirement. And so we can say that there's no different, that we shouldn't read it this way. But when we look at the elements of a failure to warn claim, that's premised on duty. And it feels like if Congress used the word requirement instead of duty, that's getting at the same thing.
And I think Bates decides that. I mean, there's a discussion in Bates about a jury verdict, which is an act that may influence corporate decision or decisions by defendants versus the underlying elements of the common law claim. And Lohr also talks about that the requirement here refers to the elements of the common law claim. And the way this analysis proceeds, as you see in Bates, as you see in the Indian brand decision of your court, right, is by way of comparison. We look at the federal standard, and the applicable standard here is the misbranding standard, and then we compare it to the state law standard. And mindful of the concept of equivalence in Bates, we ask ourselves, are these equivalent?
Can you tell me then, in performing that analysis, what is your position on the exact duty imposed by the Pennsylvania failure to warn? And under what years was Monsanto required to have that? You know, your client used the product from 98 to 2017. The diagnosis was in 2006. What years was this label inappropriate, and what was the exact duty under the Pennsylvania failure to warn? What did it have to say?
Well, the Pennsylvania law regarding a strict liability claim for failure to warn has been consistent for many, many years, and for all of the period of time that would govern this case.
The research changed.
The
opinions on
glyphosate.
Changed over time. So I think it does matter. So if you could tell me, what is your position as to the exact duty and at what time?
Okay, well let me separate two different things. One is the EPA's various statements regarding glyphosate, whether it's in the form of some kind of scientific paper or otherwise. And then separately, at the which is the top level of the
Tell me the answer, and then how those inform.
Sure, no, I understand. In terms of the state law standard, the state law standard is that a product is in a defective condition. These are the elements of a Pennsylvania claim for strict
liability. No, I'm aware of the elements. Right. I'm asking you to
the product is in a defective condition when it lacks sufficient warnings to notify the ultimate user of the dangers inherent in the product. And that's the requirement. If we accept the proposition that the common law standard is a requirement that then has to be compared to the applicable federal requirement, that is the standard that the product lacks sufficient, the product is defective.
Under your analysis and of that equivalence, what would the label have to say? If this was misbranded, what did the label have to say? Yeah. What time frames?
So let me
under
just
under your theory of the failure to warn.
So the complaint that was filed in this case doesn't articulate a warning that would have complied with Pennsylvania law. And in terms of the preemption analysis, I don't know that we have to know the answer to that question. The question is this Pennsylvania common law standard equivalent to and consistent with the federal misbranding standard? And I would say the answer to that is surely yes. But we know, just by way of example, we know that in 2022, the EPA issued
which post-dated any time that your client used the product.
I'm sorry?
Which post-dated
so that, that's,
your
that's
client's
true.
Use of the product.
That's true, but in 2022, just by way of example of a label that might well be consistent with Pennsylvania law. And I'm not a jury and I'm not the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, but we know that currently the state of California has been, it has authorized consistent with EPA's 2022 letter labels that say the International Association for the Research of Cancer has found that glyphosate is a probable carcinogen, a probable human carcinogen. The EPA has a different point of view. You should be mindful of these points of view and be aware of your exposure to this toxic chemical, right? Now, I don't know that is the only formulation, but that is a formulation where there is an acknowledgement of the carcinogenicity, and that is a formulation that might very well be consistent with Pennsylvania law.
But I guess the more that we mine down, I mean, this kind of becomes a question of level of generality, right? Like the more that we mine down, the more they aren't equivalent, because I think your position is we've got a failure to warn under Pennsylvania law because glyphosate causes cancer. And then the EPA has said we register it and we're pretty sure that it doesn't cause cancer. So if we keep going and we keep mining down, they are in tension and they are not equivalent. If we go up to a broad level and say, well, what's the macro highest level requirement? Maybe there's equivalence there, but we see in the MDA cases that they're looking device by device, not macro level, to do that. So shouldn't we look at that specific comparison between EPA saying we're fine, we register it, and then your claims under Pennsylvania law that say, no, this contrary to the EPA is carcinogenic. It's really hard, at least there's a strain there, to say that that's equivalent, genuinely equivalent. We can't read genuinely out of at least precedent.
Well, if we're gonna dig down below what I call the top level, where the requirement of state law is the common law claim, and the requirement under FIFRA is the misbranding statute, and I would say respectfully that those two standards are very equivalent, very consistent with one another, if you just look at what they say. But okay, Judge Phipps, to your point, if we're gonna go below that and look at the registration, then what we have to ask ourselves is what is registration? Right? Registration is the method by which the EPA permits a pesticide to be sold. But Congress, to the point of express preemption, what did Congress say? Congress has defined registration in very narrow terms. Congress has said that registration is prima facie evidence that a pesticide complies with FIFRA.
But
Congress has said
Mr. Becker, isn't it It's a requirement, though, right? And
it is a requirement.
Section B talks of requirements.
Well, it is a requirement that pesticides be registered in order to be sold. That is a requirement.
Part of that process is labeling, isn't it?
And labels are submitted. And when the EPA approves, when the EPA registers a product, it registers a product, including the label. But the fact of registration, that's what Monsanto was relying upon. They're relying upon the fact of registration. The fact of registration is, under the statute itself, only an evidentiary presumption of compliance with the statute.
That presumption is from 136(a)(f)(2). Isn't that...
Did you just do that right off the top of your head? That's impressive.
I have notes. Okay, but isn't that a vestige of a time when products could be registered under protest, meaning labels that did not meet EPA standards? So is that just a way to preserve post-1964 suits for labels under protest, labels registered under protest?
So Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. I know that that is what Congress has said. Congress has said that registration—
What congressional intent does it reflect that the original 1947 statute includes that, basically the sentence after it allows for registration under protest? Doesn't that reflect a congressional intent to address registrations under protest that do not meet EPA labeling requirements?
Well, I'm you'll forgive me. I'm at a disadvantage. I'm not quite sure how to answer that question. And I will acknowledge that congressional intent. There may be many congressional intents.
Let me just give a little definition to this, because this prima facie evidence phrase that you're using, it comes after there's an opening clause. It seems to have a few conditions in it when it says, as long as no cancellation proceedings are in effect. And so cancellation proceedings might be this remnant that we're talking about. And so I guess what I'm saying is, we can't just sit there and say there's no prima, that it's never prima facie evidence. We have to meet at least what strikes me is a condition precedent. And then this, I don't know that has any play with the 136J unlawfulness finding and that unlawfulness standards. And so I don't know that this phrase can say that. I think if you register a product, well, if you don't register a product, then using it's going to be unlawful. And I don't know that this matters to that, does it?
Well, if we're going to, if on the basis of express preemption, we're going to hew to what Congress has said, then whatever the intent is, Congress has said that registration has a limited, has a limited import in the context of what FIFRA FIFRA says.
But we know that one thing we know for certain is that lack of registration is unlawful, right? Like if you market a product without it being, you're in trouble.
Sure.
Like unlawful. So we know at least that much. And maybe we can build out from that then what it means if you register. And I think what you're saying is not every time you register, does that mean that you're in the clear as far as is no liability?
Certainly not.
But the problem, again, with this phrase, this prima facie evidence, is comply with the registration provisions of this subchapter. And again, we aren't saying, so it might say it's prima facie evidence vis-a-vis problems you might have with the federal government. But how is it prima facie evidence of problems you might have based on a state failure to warn suit?
Well, that gets back to the question of equivalency. If the Pennsylvania standard, if the Pennsylvania strict liability claim for failure to warn is equivalent to, consistent with the misbranding standard, then it is imaginable that that where a claim succeeds for strict liability failure to warn, it may also follow, or it may be imaginable that that the pesticide also is misbranded. I think the limited point that I want to make about registration is that while Regal concededly has a has preemption language that is similar to what we have in FIFRA, that FIFRA has different language in terms of the critical event of registration. And what FIFRA has said is that registration is only prima facie evidence, that it is not a defense to a misbranding claim. And that informs, I think, the kind of emphasis that can be given to the fact of registration itself as a basis for express preemption under the uniformity language of the preemption provision. There are other, of course, actions of the EPA. There's the fact of registration, but the EPA has also issued various papers, scientific papers, and interim re-registration decisions concerning glyphosate. And those actions of the EPA, I would suggest, happen against the backdrop of statutory requirements, but those actions are not the requirements themselves.
Can I ask you, in your position is that the appropriate level of abstraction or generality is at the top level. Is that what we concluded in Indian Brands, and are we bound by that here?
Well, that is what you concluded in Indian Brands, actually.
If we were to find differently here, would that be in contravention, or is there any room in Indian Brands for a more down in the weeds level of equivalence?
I think that you could write an opinion that evaluates and rejects express preemption at every level. That first of all, at what I'm calling the top level, when we compare the strict liability standard to the misbranding standard, we win, right? If you actually ask yourself, does the fact of registration have preemptive effect? And that's not, I'm not trying to diminish registration. Registration is an important event in a regulatory setting, but did Congress endow the fact of registration with the power to preempt an underlying state law claim? I would say the answer to that is no, given that what Congress said is that registration is an evidentiary burden and a presumption almost by definition cannot be a rule of law, cannot be a requirement. As Bates has defined a requirement. And then I think at the third level, when you go down to the various things that the EPA has done with glyphosate, that none of those amount to requirements or rules of law either. Those are statements and actions, and regulatory agencies, of course, have their point of view, and obviously the IARC has a different point of view, and there is a robust conversation that is unfolding with regard to technical glyphosate, to say nothing of formulated Roundup, which has different ingredients which make the actual product that you buy in a store more toxic according to IARC and more carcinogenic than the active ingredient glyphosate alone. But those various EPA actions do not have the formality that could render them or equate them to a requirement, to a rule of law, so as to trigger the preemption language and override the state law cause of action. And I come back to the thought that I offered at the outset, which is that FIFRA in this regard is an exercise in cooperative federalism. Congress has acted in a very limited way to override historic and traditional state sovereignty to enact laws for the health and safety of citizens, but it's very limited and limited to the concept of requirements. Regal is a different case. And Regal is a different case for a couple of reasons. One, because as a practical matter, when the FDA receives testing about medical devices, it's receiving information about those devices as tested on people, right? It is not unethical to test a pharmaceutical or a medical device on a person. And the FDA is able to evaluate all of that when assessing safety and efficacy and setting the level of a label. But bear in mind that pesticides are poisons, right? Glyphosate has only one thing that it does. Its only job is to kill things. And human beings, therefore, are guinea pigs, right? These pesticides go out into the world. The EPA eventually has the ability to look at epidemiological studies, but never ex ante is able to look at testing on how these pesticides work on people. And so that gives some context for why registration is such a limited idea and illustrates why Regal, as a practical matter, to say nothing of a legal matter, has a different texture and different considerations that render it a comparator, but not decisive on this question.
Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Thank you. And I'll leave for our brief the other question, which is the issue preclusion question, which you haven't asked about, but you have that argument.
Yep, we've got it.
Thank you.
Thanks. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could try to quickly respond to a number of points. Judge Chung, you asked about the Indian brand case, and I really strongly disagree with Mr. Becker's characterization of it. The court in Indian brands ultimately found that the defendant was trying to base preemption on a background observation where the EPA document wasn't even talking about the pesticide at issue and sort of made a stray comment. The court said we would be very hesitant to base preemption on that. I do not think anything in Indian brands endorses this incredibly high level of generality, high level of abstraction test that the plaintiffs here are proposing.
Could you tell me a little bit more about how you make that distinction? Because it seems that the court's starting point was in first assessing whether the Pennsylvania failure to warn standard imposed any different duties than the FIFRA. And it seemed to me that it said they were equivalent, but then went on to the background. So can you sort of explain to me if we're saying that those are in fact equivalent, and then you have a very robust as opposed to background, take it from there.
Sure, Your Honor. No, I think it's a great point. We're not saying that you would never do this comparison. If the state had a wildly different tort standard that just at that abstract level is in addition to or different from, that would be a reason that it's preempted. The point is the analysis just doesn't stop there. The court in Indian Brands didn't stop there. It went on, then found there was nothing else in what the EPA had done because it was just the sort of stray background statement. Here we do have, as Your Honor says, something more
robust.
But
what is the duty? Because we seem to say in Indian Brand that the duty, we have to analyze whether the duties are parallel and that the duties were parallel at that top level.
Sure, Your Honor. And there is a duty to provide the safety warnings under FIFRA. The EPA determines are required. There is a statutory process by which the EPA makes these decisions. It works the same way in Regal. So in the Lohr case, which is sort of a precursor to Regal, similar debate, similar to Indian brands, where there you did do that abstract comparison because what the Supreme Court says, there's no device specific requirement. So you just look at the general federal standard and the general state standard. Then Regal came after that and said, when the FDA does do safety review, it imposes device specific requirements under the statute. And EPA does the same here. Plaintiffs have tried to distinguish Regal, but they don't actually have any difference that matters under the statute. The one thing they raise really is this section 136 AF2. That has a lot of problems, some of which have already been discussed. But if I could add one more, it's that, let's take the text of that seriously. Registration is not a defense. And then subject to the condition precedent that Judge Phipps mentioned, registration is only prima facie evidence of compliance. We're not saying that registration is more than that. You can have a registered product that could violate FIFRA because you don't give the warnings that EPA required, because EPA never considered an efficacy issue. You might fail in your adverse event reporting requirements. All of those could be reasons that a duly registered pesticide violates FIFRA. And every one of those applies under the medical device amendments and the Regal framework as well. You could have an approved product where the FDA says, you concealed evidence, you didn't make adverse events reports, it's now misbranded. So approval, registration, not a defense, not conclusive evidence. But when you have a claim here that you have to give a warning that EPA has rejected, that is not required, that is in addition to or different from.
But I think at least when I read the Ninth Circuit treatment of this, I think they were very much of the mind that your opponent is of, which is this prima facie evidence cannot be read to mean a requirement. Requirement is something bigger than prima facie evidence. And so I think everything you said checks out. It makes sense to me. But does that get you far enough? Because don't you need to say, in addition to all of that, this prima facie evidence can be read as a requirement under the uniformity clause. So could you just speak to why you think there's consequences? I think those are good. That makes sense to me. That checks out from what I've read. But why does that get you to the point of it being a requirement? I mean, the Ninth Circuit was kind of emphatic. They said it defies logic to read it that way. And I want to know, you think it doesn't defy logic. And I want to know why you think it doesn't.
Your Honor, I don't think it defies logic. I actually think when you read what the Ninth Circuit said closely, there is, I say this with all due respect, I think there's an error there when the Ninth Circuit jumps from registration is prima facie evidence. And I think there's a line where the Ninth Circuit says, well, the label approval is only prima facie evidence. That is not what the statutory text says. We are not saying that the mere fact of registration is conclusive evidence of anything. It is part of a statutory framework. The statute requires you to get EPA approval before selling a pesticide. It requires EPA to determine what health and safety warnings are required. It requires you not to add health and safety warnings. This was raised by Judge Jaggeras before. I did want to just give a regulatory site, which is 40 CFR section 156.70 subparagraph C, which says you cannot add safety and hazard warnings without EPA approval. So there's a lot of requirements here. So our point is not registration. Just registration is something more than prima facie evidence of compliance. Our point is that Congress created a statutory framework under which when EPA does this, just like in Regal, when EPA does a safety review, does a label approval, discharges its responsibility to decide what warnings are required in order to protect health and safety, that gives rise to requirements that are specific to the pesticide, just like in Regal, just like the 10th Circuit said in Thornton with respect to decisions by the Department of Agriculture about label approvals giving rise to requirements. I know my time is up. I did have a quick factual answer to one of Judge Chung's questions, but I'm happy to stop
okay,
here.
Go ahead.
Just on the question about, you asked a question that I think relates to impossibility preemption about what is the specific, obligation that plaintiffs think that there was to warn here. And I didn't hear a clear answer from my friend. I think the answer is at page 74 of the joint appendix in their complaint, where they say the problem here is there was a failure to warn of the dangerous characteristics of glyphosate. And this is more, I think, goes to impossibility preemption than just express preemption. EPA has been seized of this for decades. It has continuously concluded to this day, it does not think that this product causes cancer. So we know EPA would not and could not approve a warning. Perhaps it could approve some sort of informational language. As Your Honor suggested, the timing doesn't even work for the informational language that the Schaffners are requesting. But the more fundamental point is, he is saying, I was injured because you did not tell me this product causes cancer. EPA would not approve that, and it is impossible to comply with the state law requirement that is being alleged here without violating federal law.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take this case under advisement. We want to thank counsel for their excellent briefing and oral argument today.